There was a brief pause as Betton powered up the battery banks for the craft's impressive linked array of fixed wing and turret Cypramundi pattern las cannons. Power runes lit up inside Berger's helmet array as the systems went live. She even engaged the pair of Stalker anti-starfighter missiles and fired off a brief salvo of red las bolts to double-check the targeting matrixes.
All weapon systems armed and ready.
Not taking any chances.
Nope, Betton said. She sounded cheerful. How long, he wondered, till she told her first joke. The last time they'd had contact was a week earlier, at the height of the Battle of Acadia. Their flagship, the Emperor-class battleship Pax Imperialis, had followed the Phalanx on its relief mission to Acadia. The planet was ringed with Black Fleet craft, like a corpse covered with the black carapaces of carrion beetles, so thick that the planet could barely be seen. What could they do, he had wondered, against such weight of numbers and hatred? There had been 20 Furies in their squadron that day, on escort duty to a similar number of Starhawk bombers. While the Phalanx went after the Blackstone, Navy captains picked their own targets, and the crews of the Pax Imperialis had a personal vendetta with the Exorcist-class Grand Cruiser, formerly named Kingmaker. The Kingmaker had a proud 8,000-year history of service with Battlefleet Scarus, but had gone missing on patrol around Agrippina 5 years earlier. It had been presumed lost until a year ago, when a ship matching its description had been spotted as part of a Black Fleet force that wiped out a convoy between Cadia and Bellis Corona. The Pax Imperialis had been sent out to hunt it down and destroy it. They'd brought the ancient craft aground around the asteroid belts of the Krenan system. On paper, there was no match. An Emperor-class battleship outmatched the Exorcist in all respects. She was bigger, faster, outranged the enemy, and carried twice as many void craft. But the Grand Cruiser had been changed. The Exorcist was no longer just a vessel. It was a thing alive. And after a brief and inconclusive firefight, the captain of the Pax Imperialis, Vice Admiral Chank, had brought her in close, so that his flights of bombers could deliver the coup de grace. It was only as they reached visual range that the true extent of the changes to the Kingmaker was apparent. Her metal skin was bulged and pockmarked. Along her underbelly, a row of red tentacles searched like the arms of an anemone. The chill of heresy had sobered them all, and prayers were broadcast over the Vox systems. The first wave of bombers was halfway to the craft when the auguries had suddenly lit up as 6 other Chaos cruisers powered up. The Pax Imperialis had been hopelessly out of position and surrounded. All she could do was disengage and make for the nearest possible Mandeville point. It had been a tough decision that involved abandoning the crews of the entire first wave to their fate. Void death was something they all feared. Berger, Betton, all of them had friends in that first wave. So when they met again in the space above Cadia, that attack had been personal. Berger had volunteered to be in the first wave. Almost all the Pax Imperialis' crew had. The destruction of that turncoat was personal. They were determined to finish the job they had started in the asteroid fields of Krenan. It had been a furious dogfight, punctuated by the exultant shouts of the bomber crews as they delivered their torpedoes at close range, the tense conversations of fighter pilots, and the death screams as they were picked off. Berger's crew had taken out 6 of the enemy craft, but the bombing run had proved unsuccessful. The Kingmaker had retreated, limping and burning, into the safety of the Black Fleet. And again, it seemed that the pride of the Pax Imperialis had been their undoing, as the vast ruins of the Blackstone had drifted towards Cadia. All this played through Berger's mind as he brought his fighter round, letting the monotone voices of the engine and gun servitors intoning their mindslave procedures wash over him. When they were far enough away from the Pax Imperialis, he diverted power to the scanning systems, and he could hear the tap, tap, tap as the course planner, Federi, started to key in the scanning protocols.
Sweep coordinates set, Federi reported,
and then,
augury on full power.
Berger felt the pressure of his suit lessen as the Fury straightened up. Behind him, his squadron fanned out in close formation, each craft a mile apart. One by one, squadron pilots reported in. Every minute there was a beep as the scanner completed its full scan of the space around them. The Black Fleet was out there, somewhere. It couldn't be long until they showed themselves. Of that, Berger was sure. The scout patrols ran elliptical flights around the evacuation fleet. It was a constant rotation. Berger's crew were sleeping for 6 hours and then flying again. Behind them was a wall of swirling red clouds, and from that, tendrils reaching out towards them. Each time Berger went out, it seemed the fingers of the warp were drawing closer. On the third scouting flight, Berger ordered his squadron to fly within 100 miles of the foremost warp cloud. The dull red light of Cadia's sun gave a ruddy sheen to a pair of old wrecked Gothic-class cruisers, floating in a gas cloud of their own vented atmospheres. There was a blip. Federi's voice was controlled but urgent. "Contacts, sunwards, bearings 889-384. Berger conferred the directions to the rest of his squadron. He voxed back to the Pax Imperialis.
"Contacts, Squadron Zeta going to investigate."
He powered forward, looking for visuals.
"Ready, Bitten?"
She ran a check on the weapon systems.
"Ready to burn."
There was a long pause. Space could be so empty, Berger thought, as he scanned back and forth through his viewport.
"I think I feel sick," Betton said.
Berger had felt the same.
"Don't look into the clouds," Berger told her.
"I'm trying not to," Betton said.
"Federi, anything?"
"There was," he said. "The scanners have lost the contact."
There was a long moment of silence, then Federi corrected himself.
"Wait, I think there's something. Can you get closer?"
Berger turned the craft sunwards once more, getting as close to the growing warp storm as he could.
"Got a visual?"
Berger stared forward. All he could hear was the swish of the blood pump flooding oxygen-rich fluid through their systems.
"Nothing," he said. "There's a light."
Bettman flipped her systems to live.
"Engaging weapons."
"It's small," Federi said. "Could be a tender or a light cruiser. Might be one of ours."
Berger saw the yellow light and brought the Fury in at speed, skimming through the red-like clouds of the warp.
"Contact," he said, and then swore. What he saw was not a tender or a light cruiser, but a man, impossibly large, standing in the warp. The man was reaching out towards him. He had a beard of snakes that melted into flames. Berger blinked. The man had gone.
"What the frick?" he hissed,
as the targeting matrixes fixed upon a swirling cloud of purple eels. Betton was firing wildly at something. Federi was groaning.
"Get us out of here,"
he hissed through clenched teeth. Berger did not know which way was back. He banked sharply and then tried to turn. Something hit his viewport. It was like flying through a flock of avians, but these were more slug-like and they splattered against the glass, leaving an image of snapping jaws. Berger felt his fingers stretch. He looked down, and his fingers were now vines reaching into the fighter. The blood pump was sloshing green fluid through his system. Suddenly, the cockpit was full of lashing tendrils. He and Betton and Federi were now one entity. They were one with Fury. As the warp swallowed them, the blind thing that had once been Berger opened up a fanged maw and screamed. The Fortress World of Kazahon. The evacuation fleet was reaching the smoking ruins of the fortress world of Kazahon when the ambush was sprung. From the warp clouds, demonic craft reached out a swirl of tentacles and impossibly fanged mouths that seized the rearmost ships and dragged them into oblivion. One of the demons was so vast, its suckered tentacle wrapped around Kazahon, and the world began to come apart under the stresses of gravity. The ships of Battlefleet Scarus could do nothing but accelerate to full speed, and then, before them, the augury scanners suddenly lit up with contacts, and the massed ships of the Black Fleet appeared, weapon batteries loaded to fire. They were lost. But then, in the darkness, a golden light shone as the phalanx appeared. It engaged Abaddon's flagship and threw the enemy fleet off balance. There was a brief moment's opening. Admiral Darmitage sent the Delos, the Marquez, and the Indomitable forward into the heretic lines. Their decks were packed with incendiary explosives. their skeleton crews steering them on ramming trajectories with the largest heretic craft before abandoning them to their fate. The Delos hit the Chaos cruiser Mother of Hell in the aft, and she detonated seconds after impact. Her plasma reactors went critical, and the secondary explosion tore the neighbouring Scion of Hell in two, her decks voiding a nebula of smoke, oxygen and bodies. The captain of the Eagle of Terror, through a series of brilliant manoeuvres, managed to avoid the flight path of the Marquez, but she hit one of the escorts, a small pirate vessel of the Crimson Claws, and tore the smaller ship apart with her explosion. The Indomitable was on a trajectory towards the Vengeful Spirit, and her pilot, Captain Gregor Knox III, a Cadian of over 300 years' service in Battlefleet Cadia, insisted on remaining aboard his bridge to steer the fireship home. Defense turrets on the Vengeful Spirit pounded the small craft, but nothing could dislodge the Indomitable from her relentless approach towards the enemy's flagship. Interceptors raked her flanks, and she was burning from a dozen wounds as she approached within 50 miles of Abaddon's flagship, and Captain Knox stared in wonder and horror at the size of it. He knew enough about naval history to recognize its core as one of the fabled Gloriana-class battleships, but thousands of years of heresy and mutation had twisted its shape and bent it to an evil purpose. Where its turrets and buttresses and cathedral windows had once been a testament to gold and pride and honour of the imperial truth, it was now twisted, malevolent and dark with arcane energies, the window ports glaring out with a dull, intense, furnace-red light. Captain Knox felt his hands shake as he steered his small frigate towards it. That his life was going to end and that of the craft he had captained for the last 110 years seemed a fair trade to damage this expression of evil. As he approached within 10 miles, he lost his void shields, and the craft began to judder with the damage she was taking. The enemy was pummeling her mercilessly. Fragments of her armoured ceramite prow were tumbling out as she drove forward through the explosions of her own destruction. When he was within 5 miles, he felt the juddering impact of a boarding torpedo slamming into the crew quarters beneath him. He diverted all power to the engine drives, squeezing out the last seconds before impact. Within 30 seconds, he could feel the tramp of power-armoured feet storming up the gantry towards the bridge. The armoured doors were 3 inches of locked ceramite, but he had no illusions as to how long they would hold the enemy back. A power-armoured hand hammered on the door, and then the melted charges blew, and he saw black shapes move through the smoke, their bolt guns raised. The mass of the Vengeful Spirit filled his crazed view portals, and then he began to laugh. He was going to make it, he saw. He was so close now, and he stepped forward to accept his fate. "Cadia stands!" he shouted, as the roar of bolt guns filled the chamber. And then the Indomitable exploded. Chapter 15. Lord Lieutenant Beric. The naval battle was just green dots within the holosphere display, with red runes flashing when a craft was destroyed. General Gruber watched the battle from the bridge of the Lord Lieutenant Beric. The courage and skill of Battlefleet Cadia was demonstrable. Crew for crew, they outfought the ships of the Black Fleet, but the Black Fleet outnumbered them almost 2-1. It was only the phalanx that saved them, drawing the Black Fleet onto its monstrous guns. As the evacuation fleet fled towards the outer system, they fought running battles with the pursuing Chaos ships. And the longer this went on, the greater the toll. Battlefleet Cadia had been punished for the last 100 days. Her crews were exhausted, her craft were damaged. One by one, they threw themselves into the jaws of Abaddon's wolves so that the troop transports could escape. It was a terrifying pursuit through the ruins of the Cadian system. The orbital defence arrays at Kazapartox were silent, their vast bastions and power generators ripped open with melter bombs, their crews slaughtered and the systems left inoperable. The docking yards of Vigilantum were a graveyard of Navy hulks, sitting like cold stars within the nebula of their own destruction, gas clouds of frozen oxygen and promethium, a pale green in the light of the distant sun. From the hive world of Makaria, a comet tail of destruction trailed behind it as its death spiral, which would see it impact in the Cadian sun, began. And where the prison world of St. Josmain's Hope had once kept watch on the outer rim of the system, There was nothing now except asteroids and a dark, bloated, pox-ridden demon ship, the Terminus Est, waiting for them, as patient, poisonous, and deadly as a spider. Gruber made his way to the top of the craft, where Navigator Hippolytus had his chambers. The door was locked, and his twinned rattlings bowed to welcome the general, but would not let him in. Gruber ran a finger around his collar. "I need to speak to him urgently," he told them.
"You cannot enter,"
the rattlings said in unison. Gruber could not accept their answer.
"We need to make the warp jump," he shouted at them. "Immediately!"
"He is not ready,"
the rattling said.
"How do we speak to him?"
"You cannot. The Lord Navigator is searching for escape. You should not question his work."
Alarms sounded throughout the craft.
Gruber shook with anger. "We have to make the jump now. The Black Fleet have surrounded us. We have bare minutes. Do you understand?"
The Pax Imperialis threw itself between the evacuation fleet and the Terminus Est and emptied her flight decks in one vast disgorgement of bombers and fighters. They swarmed out from the magnificent Imperial flagship like a flock of bees in defense of their hive. The crews knew that they were going to their deaths as the battleship turned her armored prow around and her dorsal batteries began to rake the enemy ship. There was a brief flash of hope as the vast batteries momentarily overloaded the Terminus Est's void shields. That was when the Luna-class cruiser Heart of Light fired her Nova Cannon. The immense gun shot a vast, solid metal slug at almost the speed of light. It traced an incandescent streak of white light across the sky and hit the Terminus Est a raking shot along its port side before exploding amidships. The vast Pox ship lurched through space, trailing a nebula of gas and fluids as fires broke out where there was oxygen enough to support them. But then the Terminus Est returned fire with three great salvos that hit the Pax Imperialis' void shield as one, popping its protective bubble within bare seconds, ripping into the superstructure and setting off a salvo of explosions along the great battleship's spine. Inside the Lord Lieutenant Beric, Gruber was shouting at the rattling attendants of the Lord Navigator.
"We're being destroyed! They're being ripped apart! There's only so much time they can give us!"
The rattlings linked arms.
"We cannot interrupt the Lord Navigator."
"Stand aside," Gruber ordered them.
But they did not move. The rattlings threw themselves before the doorway to the Navigator's chamber as Gruber stepped towards them. The general had become almost still with fury.
"Then we will all die," he reached for his last pistol. "And I cannot allow that to happen."
The warp jump alarms rang out across the evacuation fleet. In every ship, crewmen looked at each other in astonishment and alarm. It seemed almost impossible that the warp should have shown them the way out of the system now, when the jaws of the enemy were closing. In the Lord Lieutenant Beric, Gruber looked about him.
"What is happening?"
The rattling attendants didn't know what to say. They stared up, eyes wide, as warning lights strobed through the ship. Low in the craft, the Gallifield generator started up with a dull vibration that quickened to a low hum. Lord Navigator Hippolytus had found a route through the Immaterium. One by one, each of the Imperial ships raised their Gallifield and made the desperate leap into the Immaterium. The troops and the Lord Lieutenant Beric were thrown about as the ship entered the warp. The violence of the transition did not subside, but went on for hour after hour of terrible vibrations. In the cargo holds, tanks ripped loose from their moorings, but it was on the human crew that the buffeting passage had the most profound effect. Many were pushed beyond the limits of endurance. No one had ever seen so many patients with warp sickness. Medicare ran out of mind suppressants, as their decks filled with men and women clutching desperately at the shores of sanity. Commissars dispatched those who were driven mad, but soon entire levels of the ship were dedicated to the sick. Where they were available, sisters of battle, priests and military mendicants walked up and down, soothing the incipient madness with prayers. On ships where there were no clergymen or women available, officers read aloud from books of prayer, or even just the uplifting primer. After the tumults began to ease, Gruber had all the military reports he had not yet read brought to him. They filled an entire room with files, memos, regimental reports of cowardice or failure in the face of the enemy. But again and again were reports of a winged saint. She had been seen on almost every battlefront. Her miracles had saved unit after unit from impossible odds. Gruber found his hands shaking as he worked through them. He found tears rising. Gruber had faith in the Emperor. 3 days into the flight, there was a knock on the door. Gruber looked up, expecting to see Zabusko, but instead, a commissar entered. A tall, lean man with a narrow, hawkish look to him, and a long, hooked nose. Gruber stood up to shake the man's hand. "My name is General Gruber. To whom do I have the pleasure of speaking?" The commissar held Gruber's hand for a moment too long, as if assessing his character through his handshake.
"Colonel Commissar Greg," he said,
his voice deep and resonant for a man so thin. He looked down on Gruber, which the general found irritating. He sat down.
"Greetings. Please sit. How can I help you?"
The commissar sat back, took off his peaked hat and folded one leg over the other. There was a stiffness to his movements that suggested an old wound. Gruber waited. He took an instant dislike to the man, though, to be honest, he'd hardly ever met a commissar that he liked, and those he liked, he thought, generally made bad commissars.
"There was a serious breakdown of command in the hours of the evacuation."
Gruber sat forward and steepled his fingers together.
"Yes, of course there was. My troops were evacuating in the face of continuous attack."
Greg leaned forward.
"There was cowardice on Cadia. Gross failures on the part of your troops to carry out their basic duties."
Gruber stiffened as he leaned forward.
"There was courage on Cadia. Bravery. Stalwart defiance of the enemy."
Greg smiled from the corner of his mouth. It was a cold and unpleasant look that showed metal-capped teeth.
"In the last hours of Cadia, I shot 59 men."
"So I have heard."
"And?"
"I think it is 59 lives of my brave troops that you wasted. 59 fewer defenders of the Imperium of Man."
"In their flight, they had discarded their weapons."
"Yes," Gruber said. "I have read the reports. Guardsman Marling and Guardsman Marcus had lost their rifles because they were carrying their wounded fellows."
Gruber fumbled for the relevant paper.
"Yes, here," he said defiantly. "And you also shot the wounded men they had brought to the evacuation point. Guardsman Matterall and Sergeant Blinken." "Guardsman Matterall had been shot in the arm, which reports say was bound to his chest. Sergeant Blinken had stepped on a mine and lost her leg from the knee downwards."
"Sergeants have a responsibility to set a proper example to the others."
Gruber was trembling with fury.
"Sergeant Blinken was a veteran of 9 years. She had already twice won the Eagle Ordinary. And I have 3 reports, here, here, and here," he said, waving the papers in the air, "recommending Sergeant Blinken for the Ward of Cadia. And you shot her."
Gruber was standing. He had both fists planted on the desk.
"You shot a woman who fought with commendation and bravery for 9 years. Earned some of the highest honors available to a guardsman for the crime of dropping her rifle once wounded."
Greg seemed almost reptilian in his calm.
"Yes," he said. "I had to make an example in order to stop panic breaking out. This is not about 1 or 2 guardsmen."
59,
Gruber said, sitting back down. Greg shrugged.
"Or 59. It is about the 10,000 warriors I got safely off the planet. Other commanders managed to do so without shooting wounded men."
Greg's blue eyes were cold as steel. He made no response. Gruber sat forward.
"And what about the thousands you left behind?"
"I was obeying commands."
Gruber slammed his palm down on the table.
"You are hiding behind other men's orders. I can list 10, 20 places where the orders were disregarded, and we have 200,000 more men off the planet because of that. They put the whole operation at risk.
Gruber bit back his retort, and Greg sat forward once more.
General, the discipline of your warriors is my concern. I want the records so I can go through them to ascertain who should be executed. I have gone through the files and found 1,316 cases of cowardice that warrant punishment. Give me the list of names, and I will deal with them.
Gruber stared at him.
No, he said.
Greg's eyes narrowed slightly.
Pardon? No.
Greg smiled again, a chilling glimmer of metal teeth where his own had been knocked out.
General, I am the representative of the Commissariat.
I have pardoned them, Gruber said, and formed a penal division from their number. They will have the honor of leading our next attack.
Greg was silent for a long time. He spoke slowly, like a gambler laying his cards one by one onto the table.
That is your prerogative.
Yes, it is, Gruber said. I have no doubt that they will make up for their sins by fighting with honor and courage.
But if you have any doubts about them, then I suggest you lead them.
Greg smiled.
You're offering me a penal regiment?
Yes.
Gruber expected the commissar to refuse, but he was impressed when Greg reached one long, thin hand across the table and shook his hand.
It will be an honor, he said.
They had been in the warp for a month when, at last, the announcement came over the ship's loudspeakers.
Transition imminent!
Ships were made ready. The initial wave of relief began to stretch thin as the ship was buffeted by head currents that seemed designed to push them back into the maelstrom. The pressure mounted within the sealed troop hangars. Even experienced passengers swallowed back vomit as the temperature dropped and the warp alarms began to ring out above them. For a millisecond, there were faces and hands and gaping maws swirling about the gallifields. Across the craft, stoic men screamed for a moment as the pressure rose in their heads. But at last, it seemed that the Lord Navigator, Hippolytus Frem, had found a way back. Transiting a warp-going spaceship back into real space was like squeezing a splinter of steel from a gangrenous wound. Reality reasserted itself as the warp gave way with a burst of purple and green light. The Gallifiel blinked from existence, and the sudden loss of pressure sucked the warp light back upon itself. The explosion reversed this time, leaving the mile-long Lord Lieutenant Beric to slam back into real space at dangerous speed. The armoured nose section re-entered a full 3.2 seconds before the dorsal engineariums. The bone crunch of gravity travelled down the length of the craft in a ripple of energies. Lights flickered, heating systems coughed, and gravity generators failed across the troop decks for a stomach-churning moment. In the bridge, a dozen alarms sounded as the local superstructures failed for an instant. Across the ship, repair teams responded with well-trained speed to popped rivets, leaking bulkheads, boiler overloads. Some decks went entirely dark as reactors strained at the sudden drain of energy. Then, the shock of transition passed. The engines began to take the strain, the flicker of amber energy lighting returned to normal, and vast cogitators whirred as they adjusted the gravity generators to the orbital pull of planets and stars. Gruber was standing on the bridge as the transition happened. He was eager for his first glimpse of Holy Terror. As he stood at the viewport and looked out, Captain Zabusko checked the charts.
Are we there? Gruber said.
Zabusko looked downcast.
No, sir.
Where are we?
Zabusko shook his head.
I'm not sure.
Chapter 16. Elysian Fields. Minka fired as the first warpound appeared. It was a misshapen thing with a bunched mane of raging fire, human eyes, and a snout thick with curved fangs. The autopistol slug hit it in the chest and did nothing to slow it. She fired again, with the same lack of effect. And now she fired a third time and missed. A second, third and fourth hound appeared on the heels of the first. Wrath cursed, drew his knife and pushed Minka out of the way.
Kyria stands,
he roared, as the baying of hunters filled the air and the first hound leapt for his throat.
Brother.
His pack brothers had hunted all across Kyria. They had brought their quarry to the ground and torn them apart, and they had gloried in the battle. He knew the warpborn would come for the humans. Their souls were demon-bit, like the light of a deep-sea creature that draws fishes near. As the warphound leapt in, Scarp Hedin sprang forward. It was fast, but he was faster. He caught it by the throat. The two of them tumbled to the ground, a rolling ball of fur and fire. He tore its throat out, was on his feet before the second threw itself at him and bowled him backwards, fangs crunching down on his power armor. He punched his fingers into its eye, digging deep into the matter inside its skull. It was a blow that would have killed anything mortal, but these were beasts of the Immaterium, and the warphound howled with pain and pleasure as the space wolf set one hand on its jaws and yanked, dislocating the jaws and ripping its head from its shoulders. In an instant, it was gone, its spirit howling frustration as it was banished for a moment from the physical realm. In a frenzied blur, he tore them apart. All there was killing. It was supreme. It was glorious.
Brother, it is time. We are leaving.
In a moment, Scarp Hedin shook his head, and his berserk fury left him. He found himself staring down at the ground where he had just thrown a warphound, and it had blinked out of existence as its hold on the corporeal realm failed. There was a shadow on the floor before him. He looked up and saw a swirling purple cloud of warp energy. Something was manifesting in the air above him. He drooled with anticipation as a red figure started to solidify within the cloud. A vast red monster, whip in one hand, great brass axe in the other. Minka was on her hands and knees, retching as the warp energy swirled about her. She felt the ground shudder. She looked up. A vast shape of red fire stood above her. She closed her eyes as it took a single step forward. Kyria trembled beneath its foot. Somehow she fired her auto-pistol, but the lead round was lost in the creature's unholy flesh. Minka scrabbled backwards. The monstrous thing lifted its great axe into the air. Minka called out to the God Emperor to witness her defiance. "In the name of the God Emperor of mankind!" she shouted. There was a flash of white light and the sound of singing. She put her hand up to shield her eyes as a white shape materialized in the air above her. The winged saint is sublime, transcendent. She has wings of feathers, a silver halo, the angry face of an angel. She hangs in the air above them all. It is impossible to look at her directly. It is not the only thing about her that defies logic. In truth, she is not here. She is in 10 places at once, fighting the enemies of mankind. She lifts a sword of flaming white, yet it is not the blade that kills, but the power of her truth. Her chin is high. Her face, uplifted, does not shine with the purple light of the sky, but with the golden light of a radiant sun, a bright Terran day, a throne of incandescent gold. If she speaks words, they are like the wind in the mountain forest, a roar of natural power. Minka tries to stand, but the light is like a mountain gale pushing her back. She hears a snarling voice and knows that it is the warpborn. Light flashes, or rather darkness flashes in the light, and then she hears a low moan. It is her own voice. It is like the voices of women in childbirth, a groan that is squeezed from inside them. It is a moan of pain, of creation, of exultation. Minka stands. For a moment, she is the saint. It is her voice speaking, in the name of the God Emperor of mankind. The white light had gone. Minka fell onto her hands and knees and coughed. There was blood on her face. She did not know if it was hers or not. Her right hand was scorched red, as if she had held a brand in it. She pushed herself to her feet.
Up!
Someone was shouting. Something grabbed her arm. She could barely see. Her eyes were dazzled still. She felt giddy, felt as she had in her dreams when she saw herself hanging over the city. She had faith.
Brother, it is time. We are leaving.
Scarpheden turned. There was the lander. He seemed to remember it, and then it all rushed back to him. The assault by Ottar the White, the mounds of the dead, the lander. The lander. Its ramps were closed, its systems were active. He sprinted for the cabin, ran and caught the ladder and hauled himself up.
I am coming back now, he voxed,
as he slammed the cabin release hatch. A voice called out to him. It was not his brother's. He turned and saw two humans, a male and a female, looking up with faces drawn with terror and exhaustion.
Help us, the man said.
Scarpheden was repelled by the word. It was not a word he was used to. It spoke of weakness, of defeat. He responded with a growl and threw the cabin door open.
You cannot leave us, the man said. Our fight is not yet done. We have to take revenge.
Scarpheden paused. Revenge was a word he understood. There were many reasons not to help them. They were weak. They were human. They would slow him down. Despite that, he turned.
Can you fly? He demanded.
Rath nodded. Scarpheden approved. The space wolf reached down and held out a hand. He hauled them up one by one. The space marine turned to them and spoke. Minka stared up. The voice was deep and gravelly. She could not understand the words. He spoke again. This time she caught his guttural accent.
How do you know how to fly?
Rath nodded.
Cadian 101st Airborne, he said.
The space wolf laughed.
Fly then, he said. I hunt.
The space marine stalked inside and left the two Cadians in the cockpit. The pilot had been torn apart. The cabin was awash with clots of blood. There was no time to clean the mess. It was a scramble as they got the craft ready to fly. Rath winced as he slid into the pilot's seat.
Are you sure you can fly this? Minka asked.
Yes,
Rath said, though he didn't sound sure. Minka watched him work one-handed, pressing the activation studs. His face was pale. His breath seemed laboured. Even the light of his augmetic eye seemed dull. He forced a smile.
Of course. I was airborne once.
The engines came to life on the third try. Rath pulled a lever and found it was the wrong one. He tried each of the levers in front of him and seemed satisfied.
Right, he said. Here goes.
The engine roared as he brought them up to full strength. Then he put his hands to the controls and took a deep breath. The craft's nose lifted unsteadily. It hung 100 feet above the ground, its wings shuddering violently. Rath looked confused. He struggled to keep a level as the craft was buffeted by winds, then found the right lever and pushed the engine nozzles from lift to fly. It was a torturous flight. Minka clung on and prayed. Warp creatures flew at them, swatting themselves against the viewport. One of them was sucked into the engine, which rattled for a moment.
Thrawn,
Rath hissed, expecting the engine to rupture, but it coughed and spluttered, and then kicked back into flame. Cadia fell away behind them. Once they were out of immediate danger, the space wolf took over, ripping the captain's seat out of its mounting in order to make room for himself.
Where are we going?
Rath asked.
My brothers are waiting,
the space marine said. They did not ask any more questions. It was more than 2 hours' flight before the space wolf strike cruiser appeared before them. It was a grey slab of ceramite hanging in the void, the bloody light twinkling off the vast turrets of cannons and lance arrays. Minka barely dared to breathe as they flew into the shadow of the vast craft. There were dark openings along its side. It was to one of those that the space marine flew them. The yawning gap filled the viewport. Slaved guns tracked them as they flew into the shadowed tunnel. The Space Wolf brought the lander down with a thud that slammed Minka back against the wall. They were inside a brightly lit landing bay. The Space Wolf stood, kicked the door open and squeezed out, his power armor grating against the doorframe. He leaped the 20 feet down to the floor. Rath and Minka looked at each other.
"I'll help you," she said.
Minka helped Rath down. The Space Wolf was waiting for them.
"Come!"
he shouted, and waved them to the doorway as servo attendants moved out from the wall on tracked carriages and began to attend to the lander. Minka slipped down behind Rath. Scarp Hedin's footsteps pounded out as he crossed the floor. There were 5 more Space Marines in grey power armour standing in 2 files by the door. Rath needed a medicare, but she didn't dare move. The scale of this ship was built for Adeptus Astartes, not human. Everything was too large. The Space Wolf called out to her,
"Come!"
And she took a step forward. As she helped Rath along, the waiting Space Marines suddenly lifted their fists and made the sign of the Aquila. Minka froze at the sudden movement, but Scarp Hedin spoke.
"Do not fear. They're saluting you."
Part 4. Cadia Stands. Chapter 1. Agrippina System. Tithe servant to Cadia, the forge world of Agrippina was known as the Orb of 1,000 Scars, its inhabitants sealed within their hive complexes in order to protect them from the toxic atmospheres. 80 million industrial slaves sustained by the agri-worlds of Yeor, Dentor, and Ulthor. It was a bastion of a planet, with its own battle fleet and a trio of Ramillies-class starforts in orbit about its surface of mines, factories, refineries, and industrial complexes. And it was to Agrippina that the warp flung the Lord Lieutenant Beric, its crew and passengers, shaken and dislocated. Gruber had taken a brief rest. When he woke, he found that Lalink had somehow managed to salvage his dress uniform from Cadia. It was laid out in his antechamber. Gruber washed his face with a damp cloth and stood over the flat uniform. His fingers touched the rich brocade, and he let it fall back down.
"I think I will stay in my military garb," he said.
"I understand," Lalink said. Gruber nodded.
"Has the Navigator's Chamber opened yet?"
"Not yet, sir."
"Let me know when it does."
"I have asked to be notified as soon as," Lalink said. Gruber stared at his dress uniform for a long time and picked up his sword. He'd been given it a century before when he had been made full general. It had saved his life more than once. It felt good to hold it again. He pressed the power stud. A thin line of blue energy crackled along its single curved edge. He gave it a few swings. It hummed as it cut through the air. There was a knock at his door. Gruber sheathed the sword, buckled his belt tight. It was now 2 holes tighter. He had lost weight. They all had. In many ways. 4 months earlier, Cadia had had the best troops in the galaxy. But now they were leaner, tougher, harder. And it was his responsibility to lead them. The knock came again, more urgent this time.
"Come in," he called.
Lalink stepped inside.
"Captain Zabusko says that Lord Navigator Hippolytus's chamber will soon open."
"Thank you," Gruber said. "I shall come." There was a flurry of activity as Gruber strode through the bridge corridors of the Lord Lieutenant Beric and arrived at the doors to the Navigator's chamber. Gruber sniffed. The twinned rattlings were holding each other's hands. Gruber tried to ignore them as the doors to the chamber were unlocked. The seals opened with a hiss, and the doors slid open. Navigator Hippolytus did not appear. Gruber strode forward. The air inside had a musty, dry smell.
"Please," the rattling said, "do not go in."
"Where is he?"
"We will look," they said.
The Lord Navigator appeared slowly, limping down the steps. The tall man was bowed and bent. The rattlings brought out a chair and held the Lord Navigator's hands as he sat down. He coughed, and Gruber saw blood on the cloth that he held in his hand.
Lord Navigator?
Hippolytus looked up. The silk cloth was knotted about his head. He looked close to death. When he spoke, his voice was little more than a rattle.
General Gruber,
he said.
We have arrived. Agrippina Sector.
That is correct. You delivered us, Gruber said. Thank you. Hippolytus Phrem closed his eyes and swallowed.
It was more than I thought I could manage, General. The warp is in such tumult.
He closed his eyes once more, and an expression of sickness crossed his face for a moment.
This was as far as I could manage.
Gruber had never touched a navigator before, but he put a hand out to the mutants and gave it a reassuring squeeze.
You did well.
Did the others make it through?
The navigator asked. Gruber did not know how to break the bad news.
Some, he said. A handful of tenders. Of the big ships, the Lady of Gygax made contact an hour ago, and we have made visual contact with the Venerable Warrior.
Hippolytus frowned.
And the others?
Nothing, Gruber said. Yet. The navigator closed his eyes. Maybe they will come through.
Maybe,
the navigator said. He looked weary. You don't have any sign of them. The navigator shook his head.
Nothing. I tried to show them the way, but the gap was closing even as we made the transition.
Have they been lost? The Lord Navigator did not answer.
It is possible that they have been scattered. The warp storm was unlike any I have seen before. But yes, it is possible.
Probable. The Lord Navigator shook his head. Gruber took in a deep breath.
Well, as soon as we make it to Agrippina, we will make contact with the High Lords of Terra.
Yes,
the navigator said.
Terra must know.
As the four surviving ships of the evacuation fleet limped towards the system, Gruber established the fighting strength of the forces that had made it through the warp. It was only 90,000 men. 90,000 from a population of 900 million. 1 in 1,000 had survived the fall of Cadia. Gruber's staff left him alone. They were as stunned as their commander. An hour passed. Decisions had to be made. It was Marshal Shai Arian, a survivor of Khazar Kraf, who had the courage to come and disturb the general's reverie. He coughed.
Lord General Gruber.
Gruber slowly looked up.
90,000, he said.
Arian did not answer.
How is the Lord Navigator?
He is recovering.
Is there a way to Terra from here?
Arian inclined his head.
I will ask.
Yes, please do.
There was a long silence.
I'm not sure he could make another warp transit, Arian said.
Gruber nodded. He had dreamt of bringing the news to Terra himself, but it seemed even this small victory was to be denied him.
Any word from Agrippina?
No, sir,
Arian said.
Our astropaths have tried to contact the Forge World, but there has been no response.
In the command chamber aboard the Lord Lieutenant Beric, Lalink went through the reports with General Gruber. They were assessing the armor that they had on board. 3 Baneblades, I see the Pugilist made it, and the Excalibur and the Macarius Star. Is that Pask's tank?
No, sir, he drove the Hand of Steel.
Of course.
Any news of him?
Unfortunately not.
Witnesses report that his Titan Hunters knocked out 2 squadrons of Warhounds of Legion Ignatum before the end.
Pask was a fine fighter, a little quiet, but heroes often were, he'd found. In his mind, he went over the events on Cadia. The enemy had not planned the manner of Cadia's demise. It had been an opportunistic attack, a lucky gambit. They had won the battle, he was sure. Lalink kept talking, but Gruber had stopped listening. His mind wandered and he sat forward and said, "We should decorate Pask. Posthumously, what medals does he already have?" Lalink didn't know. "Well, we should give him something else. Damn it, we should strike a new medal for all the survivors of Cadia." Gruber mused on the name. "How's your High Gothic?" His aide made a face. He was a soldier, not a scholar. "Arian?" Gruber called. "How's your High Gothic?"
"Reasonable," the marshal said.
"Good," Gruber said, rubbing his hands together and started to explain. It was decided that the medal would be named the Invictus Crimson, and that all surviving troops would be awarded it. All Cadians, in fact, who had survived the war. Gruber had been energized by the conversation, but once the medal had been sketched, he sat down and appeared deflated once more. "What will happen to the Cadian shock troopers now that Cadia is no more?" Lalink asked suddenly. Gruber nodded.
"Well, we regroup. We raise more troops. Perhaps the Imperium will give us a new planet to settle."
Gruber rubbed his eyes. "I can't see the High Lords of Terror rewarding us for defeat." "But the years of service," Lalink said. "And besides, we did not fail." Gruber nodded.
"We did not, but we shall be blamed."
When something went wrong, great institutions needed scapegoats. "There are many in the Astra Militarum who are jealous of our status. They are jealous, frankly, that we have always been the foremost," Gruber said. "They will see the fall of the Cadian Gate as confirmation that we have failed. They will want to take our place. They will want to demote us. I cannot let that happen."
"I agree, but what can we do?"
Gruber stood.
"We have to prove that we are a force worth keeping together. If we are in Agrippina, we must take the opportunity. I shall send word to Terra. They must hear the story from us first. The Imperium cannot function without us."
At that moment, there was a knock on the door. "Yes?" Two men entered. One a short, broad man. The other was young, with a thick mop of brown hair, a round face, and the youthful beginnings of a moustache. Gruber did not know either of them.
"Yes?"
The young man hesitated.
"The captain asked me to come and see you."
"Why?" Gruber motioned him to come forward. On his chest, his jacket wore a familiar red warning label.
"Sir, I am sanctioned Psyker Rut, currently serving with the Cadian 84th.
"Ah, and this is?" The other man stepped forward.
"I am Sergeant Ivan." He patted his last pistol. "His minder."
Psykers were a dangerous weapon. Sometimes they needed to be neutralized. Gruber turned his attention to Rut.
"We lost our last astropath in the warp. I want a message sent through to Terra. Can you do it?"
Rut blanched.
"My astropathic ability is weak, I'm afraid, sir. Even at best of times, it would take an astropathic choir to send a message that far. I am a battle psyker. Telekinesis, lower delta level. As an astropath, I am kappa at best."
The man seemed a little slow. Gruber nodded indulgently.
"Can you at least reach Agrippina? We have had no response from them. There will be a choir there that can relay the message on."
"Yes, sir, I will do my best."
"Good. Communicate to them that the Cadian High Command has evacuated the planet following the collapse of the Cadian Gate. Let the Hive Worlds of Agrippina know we are in desperate need of provisions and Medicaid facilities. Reassure them that we are making for Holy Terra and require a brief stopover. Do not tell them more. The less they know at this point, the better."
2 hours later, Rut returned. He had a worn look about him. Gruber looked up expectantly.
"Yes?" "I'm afraid there is bad news."
Gruber laughed. He had heard enough bad news for one day.
"Well," he said, sitting back, "you would better tell me." "I have not managed to contact Agrippina," Rutt shook his head. I could project my voice out, but I heard nothing.
Nothing.
Rutt shook his head again.
What does that mean?
Gruber said. Rutt said nothing. No one wanted to say it out loud. Gruber put his head in his hands.
Dismissed, Rutt.
Lerlink, I'm going to lie down. Fetch me as soon as there is news. Next morning, Gruber was woken by Lerlink knocking on his door. His adjutant looked like he had dressed hastily.
Yes,
Gruber said, sitting up from his simple camp bed. He fumbled for the chrono, thinking he had missed his chime, but it was still 2 hours before ship dawn.
Sir, we have made first visual contact with Agrippina.
And?
Well, I think it's important you come see for yourself.
Gruber took the lift to the captain's bridge, where the night shift was on duty. Arion was there. The marshal had been working all night, and there were heavy bags under his eyes. Gruber strode across to the viewport. He didn't know what he was supposed to be looking at.
There,
Arion said. He pointed to a bright point before them.
What is it?
It is one of the Ramilly star forts.
And?
It has been destroyed. Arion passed Gruber a picked image. It showed what was left of the Ramilly's class star fort. The cathedral was broken and burned out, its plasma reactor dead.
And the others?
There was one more. Both of the vast bastions showed significant signs of damage.
And the third?
Arion made a face.
It is no longer here.
What do you mean, it's no longer here? Has it left?
No, Arion said.
From the debris cloud here, I think its reactors went critical.
Destroyed?
Arion nodded.
But to destroy a Ramilly's, I've never heard of such a thing.
Never mind three, Arion said.
As they drew closer to Agrippina, visual contacts began to confirm their greatest fears. Agrippina had suffered the same fate as Cadia, and she had not had the Cadian shock troop defending her. Her proud defences had been smashed. The wrecks of Battlefleet Agrippina